It's a load of oafish, mainly men, trying to jostle for power in a very brutal way. Many of them are incompetent, some are incompetent, some are just ruthless.
Russia is none too pleased about the new comedy, The Death of Stalin, with the nation's second largest political party saying it discredits the Soviet leader. It's also a razor-sharp political satire and well worth a look. From Midori House in London, this is The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. We'll sit down with David Schneider and Peter Fellows, co-writers of The Death of Stalin, shortly. Also ahead...
Vertigo, a feeling of dizziness, a swimming in the head. Figuratively, a state in which all things seem to be engulfed in a whirlpool of terror, as created by Alfred Hitchcock in the story that gives new meaning to the word suspense.
As Monocle's new travel guide to San Francisco hits shelves, we'll look at the films that have captured the city so often in a menacing tone. And...
there's a segment where Patti Smith is speaking. And so you look at Patti Smith from an audience perspective, but you also look at the faces of the people in the audience. And that tells you so much as well about who uses this space, who goes there, who's listening.
A 3.5-hour documentary about the New York Public Library may not sound like a screen sensation. We'll tell you why it's worth your while. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. The sound of Joseph Stalin coughing and collapsing to the floor, an event that ignites a ferocious and darkly comedic race for power in the new film from director Armando Iannucci, The Death of Stalin.
Stalin's dead.
He's dead.
Stalin is dead!
Oh my God.
Our general secretary is lying in a puddle of indignity.
Yeah, he's feeling unwell, clearly.
I want to make a speech at my father's funeral.
No problem.
Technically, yes, but practically.
When I said no problem, what I meant was no problem. Ignore me.
The pungent odor of power and its toxic effect on those who scramble for it are hardly new themes in modern political satire. But in The Death of Stalin, the protagonists are swearing, bumbling buffoons, the setting is Stalinist Russia, and the material is adapted from a series of French graphic novels. Unsurprisingly, those in Russia who have spoken publicly about the film haven't been quite as celebratory as the reviews here in London. One politician, Nikolai Starikov, leader of the fringe nationalist party, expressed outrage that the death of a great leader had been mined for laughs and, ironically, claimed that the film is clearly part of an anti-Russian information war. In truth, of course, The Death of Stalin isn't about mocking Russia, its people, culture, or even its government. It's a satirical portrait of the games that take place in the halls of power that could have just as easily been set in Westminster in the days following Brexit, or conversely, in Washington in the aftermath of the 2016 election. But as co-writers Peter Fellows and David Schneider explain, there was still the challenge of giving this film a uniquely Russian palette.
The thing about the film is it's wrong to get too obsessed about the Russia element. I think it's so redolent with references to our contemporary politics that we're experiencing now, with Trump, with Brexit. There's a universality to it, I think, because it's a load of oafish, mainly men, trying to jostle for power in a very brutal way. Many of them are incompetent, some are just ruthless. And I've been amazed, because when we started writing it, when we started working on it, it was before Trump was, you know, he was a twinkle in a satirist's eye. And no one took seriously that he would be president. And somehow, him becoming president, you see all these things that are in the movie that suddenly they jump out as satire, as contemporary satire. It is upset and it is about Russia. But I think it has a lot to say in general.
There's a kind of global kind of thinking at the moment of this desperateness to be offended as well, I think, that you can already see from just when the trailers went out, people are seeing a trailer and they're going, ah, this is an outrage, you know, and it doesn't matter who those people are, whether those are Russians or British or American. Why aren't they doing the accents, you know, all this stuff? And if they were doing the accents, people would complain about them doing the accents.
Yeah.
Because they're using their own...
What accent did they want them all to talk like? I don't know, what did they... It's extraordinary. I mean, we got one review, I think, said that Jason Isaacs, who does a fantastic Yorkshire accent... They first described it as a Russian accent. They thought the Yorkshire was a Russian accent. And then they changed it hastily to Yorkville. He's doing a Yorkville accent.
Yorkville.
But I think there is a logic to why everyone uses their own accents or British or American accents, is that the Soviet Empire was huge. It's stretching right from Japan in the east right over to near Poland in the west. So you'd have Ukrainians, you'd have Georgians, you'd have... Kazakhs, you know, so everyone had different accents, different languages even that they spoke. So I think that one, that's what I'd like to say to the people, say, why aren't they all speaking the same accent? Because I think it's a positive thing. It reflects what it would have been like in the Soviet Empire.
So the international aspect then, I suppose, really works for the film, because when you were speaking just then, David, I was thinking the way you describe it, this could be a satire of pretty much politics anywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, the jostle for power, the chaos that erupts when suddenly there's a power vacuum that needs to be filled.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen that in the wake of Brexit. We certainly saw it in Australia not too long ago. Just before I left Australia, and you had the musical chairs up in Canberra, where one minute it was Kevin Rudd, then it was Julie Gillard, then it was Kevin Rudd again.
Yeah.
This is really a universal story, isn't it? I suppose, unless you're in the United States, where it's actually really, really difficult to get rid of the guy at the top.
But I think there's a lot of Trump references there, or, you know, you've got Malenkov, who takes over when Stalin dies, spoiler alert. He was the deputy, and he's played by Jeffrey Tambor, and he's a guy who's completely out of his depth, who's a narcissist who dyes his hair. When we were writing it, we weren't thinking, oh, that'll be just like Trump, but there's so many moments, aren't there?
It's bizarre, but it's the magic crystal ball of Iannucci, of stuff just happens after it's been made. So, you know, with the thick of it, it was like the next week, then something that had just happened the week prior would actually happen in real life. And there's no moles or anything. It's just this kind of strange chance. And it's the same thing with this, where, like you said earlier, there was no kind of idea that Trump would be in power when we were writing the film.
Yeah, it's a universal thing.
Absolutely, that's the whole point. It just happens over and over again.
Coming from the knowledge that you have about politics and about satire, obviously you had plenty to draw upon when you were putting this material together. Was there a point where you'd come up with the overall themes, but then you thought, how do we put this into the sorts of situations and add bits and pieces in there that would make it feel as though it's actually happening in Russia?
Well, there was a lot of research that went on really from the very beginning. Me and Arm were going through probably about 20 books and just kind of pulled out stuff, which was little funny details or kind of things that could fit the universe of the film without feeling like it's making a point of being Russian. It's more incidental. It just happens to be set in Russia in 1953 rather than forcibly putting in things that people recognise as Russian. So you sort of have shots of the Kremlin in there, for example, but you don't feel like we're being signposted as, this is the Kremlin, you're in Russia now. But it's just trying to pull stuff out of the research to make it feel real.
That's the thing that is incredible about the story and what was going on in this very macabre, very dark, grotesque society that they had there. A lot of the things where you'll go, oh, that was so clever, you made that up. Actually, no, that genuinely happened. The film starts with the orchestra playing on the radio. Stalin wants the recording. They haven't got a recording. They have to lock the doors to stop the audience leaving. The conductor is so fretful and panicky that he passes out. They need to go and get another conductor. And this all happened. And in fact, in reality, the second conductor was too drunk, so they had to get a third conductor. So it's actually more ridiculous than we have in the film. You might look at the film and think, that is just hilarious. But often it's based on truth.
When you were researching those sorts of things, did you find your own impressions of the facts behind the story start to change your own visions of what Russia is and how it's come to be what it is today?
Yeah, it's very hard to kind of try and embed your mindset into that world of just pure fear, constant fear. In my mind, I was just constantly thinking all of these characters are scared all the time. Everyone's doing everything that they do because they are scared, maybe with the exception of General Zhukov, played by Jason Isaacs, who's sort of his own beast. But everyone else is just terrified of what could happen at any moment. And all of the irrational choices that the characters make are as a result of fear that they're going to die. It's just trying to understand that, just trying to think, well, if I said the wrong word in this interview, that would be the end.
And also you could think, right, I did all right in the interview, I said the right thing, that's great. And then the policy changes, so yes, what you said in the interview can get you killed. I actually wrote a play beforehand about the Moscow State Yiddish Theatre under Stalin. For them, you know, if we get a bad review for the Stalin film, then, you know, oh, that's a bit of a blow. But if you got a bad review, you thought, I'm off to Siberia or worse, you know. And it's living with that feeling where you not only did you not know if you were going to be killed if you said the wrong thing, but you didn't really know what the right thing was definitely going to be at any points, because the right thing kept shifting. And to live like that is a terrifying way to live, I think. And I hope that the film honours the people who did have to live under that regime, even though it is a comedy. You know, I think Armando's done a fantastic job at making it a comedy of terrors, honouring the awfulness of that society.
You know, all of you can kiss my Russian ass.
Don't worry, nobody's going to get killed, I promise you.
Peter Fellows and David Schneider, co-writers of The Death of Stalin, which is out in cinemas this week. Still to come, we'll wander the motion picture history of San Francisco on the screen. But first, a word from the news desk. Remember the 2008 musical Mamma Mia, featuring Meryl Streep dancing all over a Greek island to classic ABBA hits? Didn't you always think that it was in desperate need of a sequel? Well, like it or not, here we go again. Now that's actually the name of the upcoming second installment of the romantic musical comedy, with Meryl Streep back on board alongside a new superstar cast member, Cher. It's her first film in 7 years and the first time that she and fellow Oscar winner Meryl Streep have shared a title screen since 1983's Silkwood, though sadly, word is that they won't be sharing any scenes. And in more sequel news, director Luca Guadagnino says that he plans to make a series of future films based around the characters in Call Me By Your Name. Speaking here in London during the recent film festival, he said the next picture would be set in the 1990s, with a release date set for sometime in 2020. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned. The latest addition to Monocle's series of travel guides hits shelves this week, and one of the locations just happens to be one of the world's greatest cinematic backdrops. From quintessential noir titles such as The Maltese Falcon in 1941, to the Steve McQueen classic Bullet in 1968, and of course the film that many proclaim to be the greatest ever, Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. I speak, of course, of San Francisco. Perched precariously at the edge of a seawall in the shadow of the Golden Gate Bridge, Fort Point on Marine Drive offers possibly the finest vantage point from which to absorb the enormous scale of the structure. Even if you haven't yet visited Fort Point, however, you may feel as though you have. Much like the park bench in the shadow of New York's Queensboro Bridge, as seen in Woody Allen's Manhattan in 1979, this urban patch has popped up in various popular culture incarnations. Most notably, it was here that the confused Madeline, as played by Kim Novak, took a fall into the crashing waters of San Francisco Bay, prompting an urgent rescue by James Stewart's Scotty.
Madeline.
Before Hitchcock began exploring the city's dark side, other filmmakers toiling away in the B-movie noir genre of the 1940s had been casting San Francisco as the backdrop to their stories of shadow and mystery.
Ready for the unveiling? It's a pretty big moment for you, starting a new life with a new face.
You know,
Doc said he could make me look like a bulldog if he watched the job.
Lauren Bacall helps a wrongly accused Humphrey Bogart sneak past a city roadblock in 1947's Dark Passage, shortly before Agnes Moorehead takes a terrifying plunge from the window of an apartment block.
She's got you now. She wants you very badly, doesn't she? She's willing to run away with you and keep on running and ruin everything for herself. For she doesn't have you now, and she'll never have you.
And 1950's Woman on the Run pulls off a role reversal by pitting Anne Sheridan in a midnight race across the city to clear her husband's name, culminating in a scream-inducing finale atop a roller coaster. Hitchcock had spent time working in various capacities in Europe's mighty silent era film industry. In the early 1920s, German expressionism was emerging at the forefront of the continent's more sophisticated cinematic exports. Even US audiences favoured German films to their tatty, homegrown product for much of the pre-talking era. And an encounter with the great filmmaker F.W. Murnau at Germany's Studio Babelsberg piqued Hitchcock's interest in the magic of architecture in the movies. It's fitting then that, of all the locations that Hitchcock explored on screen, San Francisco should fuel his particular breed of fascination. The streets are steep, the houses tall, and the skyline often cloaked in that atmospheric fog. An attractive phenomenon for a filmmaker who introduced audiences to his preferred themes of mystery and innocence in 1927's The Lodger, a story of the London fog. Residential panorama that underpins the plot of Rear Window to the architectural design inspired by the work of Frank Lloyd Wright, as seen in North by Northwest, a key aspect of Hitchcock's genius was his ability to turn the built environment into something to be feared. Shortly after, the title designer Saul Bass's legendary opening sequence introduces us to Vertigo. For example, we're dropped mid-chase onto the precipitous rooftops of San Francisco's Russian Hill neighborhood, where Stewart's Scotty narrowly avoids a fatal fall. Vertiginous anxiety wasn't actually a main thread of the French novel upon which the film is based. Hitchcock himself planted that in his interpretation, dismissing two writers before finally settling on Sam Taylor, a San Francisco native, to complete the screenplay. The city's geography is used to resonate this thematic addition. The story reveals Novak's Madeline to be a resident of the Knob Hill neighborhood, set atop one of the city's original hills, while Scotty's Lombard Street home sits at the foot of a steep descent. To find the woman at the center of his obsession, he'll quite literally need to climb to dizzying heights. Like an icy blonde at the center of a Hitchcock film, San Francisco is aware of its beauty and the way in which it conjures intrigue. If its screen persona is one of mystery, however, the misty peaks of the real city are just as spellbinding and waiting to be investigated.
Judy, I tell you this, these past few days have been the first happy days I've known in a year.
I know, because I remind you of her.
That's one of the essays you'll find in Monocle's new travel guide to San Francisco, which hits shelves around the world this week. Up next, we will spend 3.5 hours in the New York Public Library. Stay with us. The clever experts at MUBI have put together a standout list of titles this week, including one of the most important documentaries you're ever likely to see. Homeland, Iraq Year Zero, is one of the very few films to depict the US invasion of Iraq from the perspective of those living in the country. Shot over several months by director Abbas Fadel, the film captures the bleak anticipation of the invasion, the mounting strikes, and the devastating consequences, all with heartbreaking clarity. If the daily news cycle sometimes desensitizes our capacity to really understand the reality on the ground in Iraq and other war zones, this is a film with a firm grasp on the human cost of war. Homeland, Iraq Year Zero is just one of the films screening on Mubi right now. Mubi, of course, is the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning films. Sample a month for free by heading over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. The curtains have finally closed on this year's film festival here in London, which means we're starting to get a clearer picture of some of the films that we'll be talking about over the next few months as the award season gets underway. And while Call Me By Your Name and The Killing of a Sacred Deer have certainly generated plenty of press, there was another somewhat less likely star that emerged from London's film festival this year. Tara Judah, the documentary Ex Libris, the New York Public Library. It's a 3.5-hour documentary about a library. Now, look, on paper, it sounds, well, a little dull.
I think it's so important to say that you need to discard what this looks like on paper. I understand the reticence coming to something, thinking, oh my goodness, 3.5 hours of library in a cinema. But what's fantastic about this film is that, one, you don't feel the 3 and a bit hour runtime. In fact, just get that out of your head. Do not see that as a barrier. And second, that it will completely challenge what you think about libraries and what you think that they mean. So what's magnificent about this film, it's from a very well-established filmmaker, Frederick Wiseman. He's a documentarian. He's made hundreds, that's an exaggeration. He's made about 40 or 50 films over his career that are just incredible documentaries that really get inside places that are often not really accessible to the public. So things like the Paris opera, ballet opera, La Danse. He made a film, Crazy Horse, Jackson Heights at Berkeley. These films that go into different places and kind of bring out something about the interior, about the people, about what happens there. And so in New York Public Library, what he does is he goes inside the New York Public Library, but also all of its branches. So in the Bronx and in Chinatown as well, not just the main library in Manhattan. And we see such an incredible swell of humanity. There's so much more to this picture than the idea of keeping books and archives. I mean, those things are in there for people who love that, but it's so much more than that. So he examines everything that's important in America and the world right now. Now with austerity especially. So he looks at the history of slavery in the US, the way in which race relations and socioeconomic disparity play out. He looks at access issues, what role a library plays in a community, how it helps people to build and further their lives. And so it's such an incredibly important film, I think. It's really urgently needed because it shows us so much about humanity. And it just broke my heart in a million pieces multiple times. It's breathtakingly good cinema.
It's interesting to note the kind of topics that Frederick Wiseman chooses, because I think most of the time when we talk about documentaries, we envision them to be about a very specific thing. And to say, oh, I made a documentary about the library, you'd think, oh, it kind of sounds like a glorified publicity video or something. You know, it's difficult to imagine, how can you make a focused film about something as broad as just a library? And yet, this is the approach that he's employed right throughout his career.
I think if anyone else had have made this film about a library, that it probably would be the sort of dull thing that you're expecting when you say on paper it doesn't look that exciting. And I think that's unfortunate that might put some people off, because he has a skill in documentary filmmaking that so many filmmakers just don't have. We often see that documentary is really led by its content, and so it gives us the story, and that's supposed to be enough for us to go in. I think Blackfish is a really good example of that, where it's like a groundbreaking story for people who don't know about the treatment of orca whales in captivity at SeaWorld in the US predominantly, but how that reverberates around the world. But the actual documentary style is not particularly interesting. So it's a lot of kind of talking heads and stock footage and the sort of typical things and the typical music that you would expect employed to manipulate your emotions and to give you a sense of what's going on. But Frederick Wiseman doesn't do that. He makes his films in a very different way. And so the most important, and I guess interesting thing about how he works is that where he positions the camera and the time that he gives to his subjects is what makes you feel like you're really involved in what's going on. So it's a very observational mode of storytelling, but it never feels voyeuristic. He looks at the people who are talking. So, for example, when there's a segment where Patti Smith is speaking, and so you look at Patti Smith from an audience perspective, but you also look at the faces of the people in the audience. And that tells you so much as well about who uses this space, who goes there, who's listening, as well as who's speaking. So the power dynamics are not such that you're only ever being talked to. He doesn't put himself in the film. You never hear him ask the questions. You never see his face. But he is always making sure that you are at exactly the right distance from the people in the frame so that you get a sense of feeling like you're there and that you understand what actually that space is about. He's very generous with his subjects as well. He gives them enough time. You know, a lot of filmmakers want them to elucidate what they're saying and just say it. Whereas Frederick Wiseman lets the way that they speak, the way that they act, and the room itself add to the volume of kind of clarity of what he's saying. And I just think that that's a really unique skill that he has. And that's why he's able to make these documentaries that are, in terms of runtime, much lengthier, but they feel lean. They're certainly not bloated. There's nothing there that you could cut out. There's not a second in this film that shouldn't be there.
Good morning. Thanks for calling Ask YPL. How can I help?
I see you've got one book on hold called Working with Bereavement.
Oh, the Gutenberg Bible is temporarily unavailable for viewing.
A unicorn is actually an imaginary animal.
This collection opened in 1915. In the past 100 years, every single working artist in New York City probably used this collection. Andy Warhol stole lots of stuff from us.
This is the world's largest circulating free picture file. This is a place that's meant to be used by people who make things.
Keep an eye out for the release of Ex Libris, the New York Public Library, over the next few months. Thank you to Tara Judah for joining us today. And that's all for this week's program. Next week, it's our Halloween special. I'll be joined by the Norwegian filmmaker Joachim Trier to discuss his fantasy thriller, Thelma.
I'm always worried when I make a film, you know, that I've gone too far or that it's strange. But I think that's what's fun about this as well. We owe the audience to take some risks and play around a bit.
Today's show was edited and mixed by Christy Evans and researched by Yulin Goffan. The Cinema Show, of course, is back next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.